He kind of started all the plants growing, and he started people. Well, I guess he's kind of big and fat.
He can see us whatever we do. Whatever we do, he has such powerful eyes. He doesn't have millions and thousands and billions. And he can still see us when we're bad.
He could be sitting on the table right now, but you can't see him.
He can't be everywhere at once doing everything for everybody. Everybody can't get what they want.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Operation Restore Christian America. This is a live broadcast. It's June 19th. The title for today's broadcast is John Quincy Adams, Letters on Freemasonry. This should be a very interesting broadcast, and there are a few developments that I'll get to after we go through some Bible verses to set up the broadcast for today, because obviously Freemasonry is something that needs to be investigated and studied much more deeply, because obviously the king of internationalist Freemasonry is King Charles III. So anyway, we're going to do a little Bible study here. Once again, we're going back to the wisdom of King David, Psalm 120. In my distress, I cried unto the Lord, and he heard me. Deliver my soul, O Lord, from lying lips and from a deceitful tongue. What shall be given unto thee, or what shall be done unto thee, thou false tongue? Sharp arrows of the mighty with coals of juniper. Woe is me that I sojourn in Mesech, that I dwell in the tents of Kedar. My soul hath long dwelt with him that hateth peace. I am for peace, but when I speak, they are for war. That's the Old Testament. It's called the Old Testament. Now let's move to the New Testament in the book of Mark, beginning at chapter 2, verse 23. And it came to pass that he went through the cornfields on the Sabbath day, and his disciples began, as they went, to pluck the ears of corn. And the Pharisees said unto him, Behold, why do they on the Sabbath day that which is not lawful? And he said unto them, Have ye never read what David did when he had need and was an hungered, he and they that were with him? How he went into the house of God in the days of Abiathar, the high priest, and did eat the showbread, which is not lawful to eat but for the priests, and gave also to them which were with him. And he said unto them, The Sabbath was made for man, and not man for the Sabbath. Therefore, the Son of Man is Lord also of the Sabbath. Now let's just move over to Luke chapter 3, and let's begin at verse 12 through verse 14. Then came also publicans to be baptized, and said unto him, Master, what shall we do? And he said unto them, Exact no more than that which is appointed you. And the soldiers likewise demanded of him, saying, And what shall we do? And he said unto them, Do violence to no man, neither accuse any falsely, and be content with your wages. Now, in Mark, the eating of the showbread that was sacred bread, this was Jesus' words here. In Luke, the questions by the tax collectors called publicans we call them Republicans now, but as a digression here. But anyway, these are the words of John the Baptist. And this, in my opinion, is something that should be brought to the attention of the key people that are in decision-making positions that have to do with the escalation of warfare between Russia and a proxy war in Ukraine, because these political leaders could use this as a modus vivendi to begin discussions again, because the last report that I have received is that Vladimir Putin himself said that there's no more time or no more room for discussion any longer. And as he purports to be a Christian, I'm not entirely familiar with the Bible he reads from, but it is a possibility that this is something that he has overlooked, and it should be brought to the attentions of these political leaders that the marching orders that have not been contradicted anywhere within the scriptures by Jesus, that John the Baptist delivered here, are valid. And if not, it would be an interesting discussion, at least among us, to figure out why they're not valid and who invalidated the words of John the Baptist, who baptized Jesus, even. Anyway, with that being said, I have some announcements to make. Number one announcement, if you have a pen or a pencil, this is a call-in radio broadcast. It has taken some time to get to the point where we were able to do this. And the call-in number is 608-433-9306. This call-in number is to be utilized only between 3 and 4 p.m. Central Time on Mondays. I'm going to repeat that again, 608-433-9306 is the call-in number, and it is to be utilized only between 3 and 4 p.m. on Mondays to talk live on air. And the basic decorum is to keep it clean. This is a broadcast that is intended for men and women and children. In other words, all people. So keep it clean. Now, another announcement is there are 3 additional radio stations that are picking up this live broadcast. Praise the Lord. And they are 1630 a.m. in Hobbs, New Mexico, 1690 a.m. in Clovis, New Mexico, and 1710 a.m. in Farmington, New Mexico. So I welcome all of you in New Mexico that are listening over the radio. Now, anyone that cares to can call in at any time throughout the broadcast. Once again, this is a family-friendly show, and it's intended to restore some dignity and decency back among people. So please do respect that, because the board operator will not tolerate any disgust, and it won't be tolerated by me either. I will entertain any discussions as long as you keep it honorable. All right, now today's broadcast, as I said, is named John Quincy Adams, Letters on Freemasonry. Now, this particular information is located, it's posted on my website, genuinechristianitynow.com, for you, each and every one of you, if you care to investigate, and I hope and pray you do, so you find out the truth about Freemasonry, because it affects each and every man and woman anywhere in the world, and children, obviously, of course. Anyway, I ordered a hard copy of the material from a website that the man has passed away now. His name was Tex Mars. And so I have a hard copy in my hand that I'm going to read something from the out of the foreword in this copy to begin the discussion. And once again, I do invite calls at the new number that I have already related. And so I'll begin reading this. And this is the foreword. John Quincy Adams and Freemasonry. The question of Freemasonry and the controversy over its character, whether the fraternity is good or evil, has long been a feature of American life. Since the earliest days of the American Republic, politicians, clergymen, and ordinary citizens alike have engaged in vigorous debate and investigation into the virtue, purposes, and meaning of the Masonic Lodge. For John Quincy Adams, writer, poet, faithful husband, patriot, former ambassador and secretary of state, and sixth president of the United States, there was no question. The dispute was firmly settled in his mind. The teachings and practices of Freemasonry, Adams asserted, are detrimental, noxious, and unfortunate. John Quincy Adams was persuaded that the lodges were a bane to society, evil, and Luciferian. So convinced was Adams of the devilish and negative effects of Freemasonry in the affairs of men, that the former president of the United States helped to found the anti-Mason political party. In 1830, he was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives on the anti-Mason party ticket. For many years, Adams carried on an active and heated literary and speaking campaign against Freemasonry. This book, Letters on Freemasonry, contains examples of correspondence written by John Quincy Adams on the controversial subject of Freemasonry. A brief biographical sketch of John Quincy Adams is in order. His illustrious father, of course, was John Adams, one of America's most famous and revered founding fathers. While the fortunes of history favored his courageous father, the son, John Quincy, also successfully carved out for himself a sterling place in history. As a precocious young man, he traveled and lived in Europe with his parents and relatives. By age 10, he was already reading Shakespeare and took up a formal education at the distinguished Passy Academy in near Paris, France. He went on to master Latin, Greek, French, Dutch, and Spanish languages and studied law. He graduated from Harvard University in 1787, second in his class, distinguishing himself with academic honors. After serving in succession as Minister to Great Britain, U.S. Senator, and Secretary of State, Adams ascended to the presidency of the U.S. following the election of 1824. Among his achievements as chief executive were extended roadways and the construction of the Chesapeake and Ohio Canal. Earlier, as Secretary of State, he helped formulate the Monroe Doctrine. As a U.S. representative, Adams was responsible for the founding of the Smithsonian Institution. John Quincy Adams was neither a social backslapper nor a smooth operator type of politician. He was known as quiet, sober, plain-spoken, and serious, and he was dedicated to the improvement of his country. Interestingly, Adams recognized and was keenly aware of his uncompromising nature and less than charismatic personality. He wrote in his diary, "I am a man of reserved, cold, austere, and forbidding manners. My political adversaries say gloomy and unsocial." Adams lamented this defect in my character and remarked, "I have not the pliability to reform it. I never was and never shall be what is commonly termed a popular man," Adams concluded. "I have no powers of fascination, none of the honey." Perhaps he had no fascination and honey to attract and influence people, but what John Quincy Adams did have was considerable. He had the respect of his peers and he earned the admiration of the people. Adams was strong in opinion, single-minded, determined, honest, and highly intelligent. Though he checked his temper, he did not hesitate to stand up for what he perceived as injustice, unrighteousness, and wrongdoing. Adams never quit fighting for the abolition of slavery. In 1841, in the Amistad case, he argued successfully before the Supreme Court to win freedom for black slaves who had engaged in a mutiny against oppressive white slave masters aboard the Spanish ship Amistad. No doubt it was his sense of duty as a Christian which so compelled Adams to fiercely battle against injustice and prejudice and to support freedom, liberty, and human rights. The authors of The Complete Book of the Presidents note that John Quincy Adams was a devout Christian. They add, "He attended church regularly and often worshiped twice on Sunday. All his life, before retiring each night, he recited prayer. In the morning, he invariably read several chapters of the Bible before starting his day." Adams occasionally wrote of his faith, testifying, "I have at all times been a sincere believer in the existence of a supreme creator of the world and of the divine mission of the crucified Savior, proclaiming, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself." On his deathbed on February 23, 1848, realizing his grave condition following a massive stroke, Adams simply said, "This is the end of the earth. This is the end of earth. I am content." And he gave his last breath. Now the call-in phone number, ladies and gentlemen, is 608-433-9306. The switchboard has just been set up, so please do call in and get on air and have a discussion about this extraordinary man. I'll continue reading until we get a call. "It was, I am convinced, his strong Christian faith and religious convictions, as well as his thirst for justice and his common sense, that ignited the intense desire in Adams not only to expose the falsehoods inherent in Freemasonry, but also his desire to discourage men of goodwill from joining or participating in what he clearly saw as an unethical, unscriptural, and unholy secret society. If he needed any additional justification, it was the tragic murder of Captain William Morgan in the state of New York in the year 1826 that further heightened Adams' sense of urgency to warn of the dangers of the Masonic Lodge. Morgan, an ex-Mason, had revealed some of the secrets of the Masons, oaths, handshakes, and ritual trappings, etc. In retaliation, he was ritually murdered in a particularly gruesome manner and his lifeless, mutilated body abandoned in a lake. The facts of Morgan's murder were subsequently covered up by lawful authorities, reputed themselves to be Masons. When evidence ensued that the Masonic Society had assigned the culprits responsible for Morgan's death to elude capture and escape punishment, the event caused a national scandal. Newspapers and periodicals across America, especially those whose publishers and editors were not Masonic initiates and supporters, carried all the gory details of the Morgan affair. Politicians were forced to take sides. Some went so far as to found the anti-Mason political party to elect candidates and enact legislation to overturn what many feared and suspected was the undue influence of the Lodge throughout government and society. Adams was instrumental in founding this anti-Mason party. But politics was only one arena of life in which Adams overtly took on his Masonic opponents. For him, this was a holy cause. He set out to investigate and learn all he could about Freemasonry. And in the backwaters of the Morgan affair, there were many former Masons who had renounced their involvement and were willing to share their knowledge. The significance of John Quincy Adams' campaign in opposition to Freemasonry is vital. Indeed, the debate regarding the merits and demerits of the secret society continues to this day. From its high point in 1959, the number of master Masons has continued to slide, even though the general male population of the United States has rapidly grown. According to the Masonic Services Association, in 1959, there were 4,103,161 Master Masons in lodges in the USA. By 1997, that number sank to just 2,021,909, and indications are that membership continues to erode. It is very possible that the more recent ferocious opposition to the Masonic Lodge in the 1990s is at least partly responsible for this dramatic drop. If so, admitting my own bias, I am glad. I count myself as one of those who oppose Freemasonry. My reasons are many, though they center mainly on my informed conviction that the Masonic Lodge is unchristian, generally amoral, and decidedly unwholesome. Indeed, I view today's Freemasonry as a loathsome leftover of the old pagan religions and an unfortunate reminder that a virulent form of occultism and Egyptianism lingers on within the boundaries of these United States. I readily admit the Lodge is responsible for some worthy humanitarian endeavors, and there are some good men who are Masons. Nevertheless, its origins, nature, rituals, and practices negate whatever noteworthy attributes there are pertaining to lodge membership. If Masonry was a negative force detrimental to the spiritual welfare of men in the day of Adams, it is much more so today. Following the great U.S. Civil War, 1861 to 1865, a man named Albert Pike became Sovereign Grand Commander of Scottish Rite Freemasonry. Pike overhauled and revised the lodge rituals, implementing a 33-degree system of initiations that is far more radically anti-Christian and pagan than was previously in place. Moreover, more recent Masonic leadership has continued to promote a universal theology and other distasteful aspects of Freemasonry, which fall, in my opinion, on the dark side. Tremendous research in this matter by authoritative researchers Ralph Epperson, John Ankerberg, James Wardner, Ed Decker, Bill Schoenoblin, Kathy Burns, Reginald Haupt, James Holly, Jim Shaw, Tom McKenney, Jack Harris, E.M. Storms, and by many others confirms my own findings. Thus, the warnings of John Quincy Adams, if anything, strike with greater clarity and impact today than they did upon their first publication in the 19th century. A slight digression for a moment. It occurred to me earlier today. Is Joe Biden a Freemason? Anyway, to continue. With this in mind, I consider the writing of John Quincy Adams in this insightful volume, Letters on Freemasonry, remarkably current and a godsend. I heartily recommend this book to every thinking and caring man and woman on earth, and especially to the men who frequent the Masonic Lodge. Let them read what one of our nation's most excellent leaders and builders had to say about the Lodge. Then may they well compare the teachings, rituals, and symbols found behind the lodge's closed doors to the open doctrines and marvelous principles prescribed and contained in God's holy word, the Bible. I believe that, having done so, no true Christian, no earnest seeker of religious truth will continue in the Masonic Lodge. Surely a Christian can be a Mason, but if the truth of Christ lies within his heart, that man will not for long remain a Mason. And that's a foreword by Tex Mars in Austin, Texas at the time. Well, let's dig into it a little deeper and start reading the letters on the Masonic Institution by John Quincy Adams. Now, this is a little peek into history as this material was exchanged. These letters were exchanged between very significant Freemasons of his time with John Quincy Adams. And I might add, there is no profanity within this profound work. These were men of high integrity that did not have to use language that was so, well, spurious and obscene to try to get someone's attention. They simply had exchanges about the reality of the situation of their time. Well, I have to go with the preface first. There's a very long preface here before we get to the actual letter. I want one thing to build on the other here. So I'm just going to continue in this book and read the preface now. It is now 20 years since there sprung up in the United States an earnest and at times a vehement discussion of the nature and effect of the bond entered into by those citizens who joined the Society of Free and Accepted Masons. The excitement which arose in consequence of the disclosures then made had the effect, at least for a time, if not permanently, to check the further spread of that association. The legislative power of some of the states was invoked and at last actually interposed to prevent the administration of extrajudicial oaths, including, of course, all such as were constantly taken in the Masonic order. This was the furthest point which the opposition ever reached. It did not succeed in procuring the dissolution of the organization of the order, or even the repeal of the charters under which it had a recognized existence in the social system. From the moment of the adoption of a penal law deemed strong enough to meet the most serious of the evils complained of, the apprehension of further danger from Masonry began to subside. At this day, the subject has ceased to be talked of. The attention of men has been gradually diverted to other things until at last it may be said that few persons are aware of the fact, provided it not be especially forced upon their notice, that not only Freemasonry continues to exist, but also that other associations partaking of its secret nature, if not of its unjustifiable obligations, not merely live, but greatly flourish in the midst of them. Fully aware of this state of things, a few private citizens who deeply interested themselves in the investigation of the subject when first agitated, yet feel as if their duty was not entirely performed so long as they shall have left undone any act which in their estimation may have the effect of keeping up among their countrymen a vigilant observation of the nature and tendency of secret associations. Without cherishing the remotest desire, even if they could be supposed to entertain the expectation of reviving an old excitement, they are nevertheless most anxious to put in a permanently accessible shape some clear and strong exposition of the evil attending similar ties, as that evil was illustrated years ago in an examination of the Freemason's Oath. And once again, the old excitement that's being referred to was the murder of Captain William Morgan, who left Freemasonry. So they murdered him for telling about this in a book. Such an exposition, they knew, could be found in the writings of the Honorable John Quincy Adams. But although the various papers in which it was first issued to the public enjoyed an extensive circulation at the period when it was written, and without doubt contributed much to the establishment of an improved state of popular opinion, they are believed never to have been collected together in any one form readily open to the public examination. Another digression, please. The letters on Freemasonry are posted on genuinechristianitynow.com. For those of you that are traveling, they're posted there in a new article. So they're definitely worth reading every last one and studying so that you can come to the conclusion for yourself, whether you be a Freemason or not, as to whether Freemasonry is ironic or vicious. Anyway, to continue, this great deficiency, it seemed to the gentlemen who have been already alluded to, a desirable object to supply. They accordingly undertook the task of publishing the present volume, not as a matter of sale, but solely with the intention of gratuitous distribution. And first of all, they deemed it no more than proper to communicate with Mr. Adams himself and to get his opinion upon the subject. That gentleman very cheerfully consented to aid the effort, not only by supplying some entirely new documents which have never before been printed, but also by promising a recapitulation of his views in the shape of an introductory essay. The execution of this last engagement has, however, been prevented by the late, much regretted illness which has befallen him. The task of preparing a preface has, by this unexpected event, been made to fall into other hands by which it must be fulfilled in a far less comprehensive and satisfactory manner than it would have been by him. The institution of Masonry was introduced into the British colonies of North America more than 100 years ago. And one more digression, that would mean at least 1747 or before, when Freemasonry was first introduced from England, aka Great Britain. To continue, it went on slowly at first, but from the time of the Revolution, it spread more rapidly until in the first quarter of the present century, it had succeeded in winding itself through all the departments of the body politic in the United States and in claiming the sanction of many of the country's most distinguished men. Up to the year 1826, nothing occurred to mar its progress or to interpose the smallest obstacle to its triumphant success. So great had then become the confidence of the members of its power as to prompt the loud tone of gratulation in which some of its orators then indulged at their public festivals, and among these none spoke more boldly than Mr. Brainerd in the passage which will be found quoted in the present volume. He announced that Masonry was exercising its influence in the sacred desk, in the legislative hall, and on the bench of justice. But so little had the public attention been directed to the truth he uttered that the declaration passed off and was set down by the uninitiated, rather, as a flower of rhetoric with which young speakers will sometimes magnify their topic than as entitled to any particularly serious notice. Neither would these memorable words have been rescued from oblivion if it had not happened that the very next year after they were uttered was destined to furnish a most extraordinary illustration of their significance. In a small town situated in the western part of the state of New York, an event occurred in the autumn of the year 1826, which roused the suspicions first of the people living in the immediate neighborhood and afterwards of a very wide circle of persons throughout the United States. A citizen of Batavia suddenly disappeared from his family without giving the slightest warning. Rumors were immediately circulated that he had run away. But there were circumstances attending the act which favored the idea that personal violence had been resorted to, although the precise authors of it could not be distinctly traced. The name of the citizen who thus vanished as if the earth had opened and swallowed him from sight was William Morgan. He had been a man of little consideration in the place in which he had been but a short time resident. Without wealth, for he was compelled to labor for the support of a young wife and two infant children, and without influence of any kind, it seemed as if there could be nothing in the history or the pursuits of the individual to make him a shining mark of persecution on any account. So unreasonable, if not absurd, did the notion of the forcible abduction of such a man appear that it was at first met with a cold smile of utter incredulity. Among the floating population of a newly settled country, the single fact of the departure of persons having few ties to bind them to any particular spot would scarcely cause remark or lead to inquiry. Numbers, when first called to express an opinion in the case of Morgan, at once jumped to the conclusion that he had voluntarily fled to parts unknown. So natural was the inference that even to this day, many who have never taken any trouble to look into the evidence are impressed with a vague notion that it is the proper solution of the difficulty. In ordinary circumstances, the thing might have passed off as a 9 days wonder, and in a month's time, the name of Morgan might have been forgotten in Batavia had it not been for a single clue which was left behind him and which, at first followed up from curiosity, soon excited wonder, and from this led to astonishment at the nature of the discoveries that ensued. The single clue which ultimately unwound the tangled skein of evidence was this: the sole act of Morgan while dwelling in Batavia, which formed any exception to the ordinary habits of men in his walk of life, was an undertaking into which he entered in partnership with another person to print and publish a book. This book promised to contain a true account of certain ceremonies and secret obligations taken by those who joined the Society of Freemasons. The simple announcement of the intention to print this work was known to have been received by many of the persons in the vicinity, acknowledged brethren of the order, with signs of the most lively indignation. And as the thing went on to execution, so many efforts were made to interrupt and to prevent it, even at the hazard of much violence, that soon after the disappearance of the prime mover of the plan, doubts began to spread in the community whether there was not some connection in the way of cause and effect between the proposed publication and that event. Circumstances rapidly confirmed suspicion into belief and belief into certainty. At first, the attention was concentrated upon the individuals of the fraternity discovered to have been concerned in the taking off. It afterwards spread itself so far as to embrace the action of the lodges of the region in which the deed was done. But such was the amount of resistance experienced to efforts made to ferret out the perpetrators and bring them to justice that ultimately the whole organization of the order became involved in responsibility for the misdeeds of its members. The opposition made to investigate only stimulated the passion to investigate. Unexampled efforts were made to enlist the whole power of the social system in the pursuit of the kidnappers, which were as steadily baffled by the superior activity of the Masonic power. In time, it became plain that the only effectual course would be to go, if possible, to the root of the evil and to attack Masonry in its very citadel of secret obligations. The labor expended in the endeavor to suppress the publication of Morgan's book proved to have been lost. It came out just at the moment when the disappearance of its author was most calculated to rouse the public curiosity to its contents. On examination, it was found to contain what purported to be the forms of oaths taken by those who were admitted to the first 3 degrees of Masonry: the entered apprentices, the fellow crafts, and the master masons. If they really were what they pretended to be, then indeed was supplied a full explanation of the motives that might have led to Morgan's disappearance. But here was the first difficulty. Doubts were sedulously spread of their genuineness. Morgan's want of social character was used with effect to bring the whole volume into discredit. Neither is it perfectly certain that its revelations would have been ultimately established as true had not a considerable number of the fraternity, stimulated by the consciousness of the error which they had committed, voluntarily assembled at Leroy, a town in the neighborhood of Batavia, and then and there, besides attesting the veracity of Morgan's book, renounced all further connection with the society. One or two of those persons subsequently made far more extended publications, in which they opened all the mysteries of the Royal Arch and of the Knight Templar's libation, besides exposing in a clear light the whole complicated organization of the institution. Upon these disclosures, the popular excitement spread over a large part of the northern section of the Union. I'd like to digress one moment or two here to say a couple of more things. I'm not making any income or any money from the promotion of this book or what I'm about to tell you. As I said earlier, Tex Mars produced this and wrote the foreword in it. Now, as I understand it, I researched letters on Freemasonry, Tex Mars, and that's how I was able to purchase this book in a hard copy, even though Tex Mars has already passed away. So it was, at the time that I bought it, not that long ago, still available, and I highly encourage everyone to get a hard copy of this, because reading from a book is not quite as hard on the eyes as reading from a computer screen. But anyway, John Quincy Adams' Letters on Freemasonry is worth to have in your library to study. And I'll continue. It crept into the political divisions of the time. A party sprung up almost with the celerity of magic, the end of whose exertions was to be the overthrow of Masonry. It soon carried before it all the power of Western New York. It spread into the neighboring states. It made its appearance in legislative assemblies and there demanded full and earnest investigations, not merely of the circumstances attending the event which originated the excitement, but also of the nature of the obligations which Masons had been in the habit of assuming. Great as was the effort to resist this movement and manifold the devices to escape the searching operation proposed, it was found impossible directly to stem the tide of popular opinion. Masons, who stubbornly adhered to the order, were yet compelled under oath to give their reluctant testimony to the truth of the disclosures that had been made. The oaths of Masonry and the strange rites practiced simultaneously with the assumption of them were then found to be in substance what they had been affirmed to be. The veil that hid the mystery was rent in twain, and there stood the idol before the gaze of the multitude in all the nakedness of its natural deformity. Strange though it may seem, it is nevertheless equally certain that the most revolting features of the obligation, the pledges subversive of all moral distinction, and the penalties for violating those pledges were not those things which roused the most general popular disapprobation. Here, as often before, the shield of private character, earned by a life and conversation without reproach, was interposed with effect to screen from censure men who protested that when they swore to keep secret the crimes which their brethren might have committed, provided they were revealed to them under the Masonic sign, they did nothing which they deemed inconsistent with their duties as Christians and as members of society. That sentence must be repeated, ladies and gentlemen. Here, as often before, the shield of private character, earned by a life and conversation without reproach, was interposed with effect to screen from censure men who protested that when they swore to keep secret the crimes which their brethren might have committed, provided they were revealed to them under the Masonic sign, they did nothing which they deemed inconsistent with their duties as Christians and as members of society. It is time for one more digression. There is a profound difference. There is as far as the East is separated from the West, difference between Freemasonry and genuine Christianity. And what I just read and then reread in that sentence is what now is in urban language called a dindu. A dindu nothing. In other words, this was the Enlightenment era, and so the English gathered together occultism from the nations in the past, and they concocted this neo-occultism called Scottish Rite and York Rite Freemasonry, two of them, one Jewish, obviously, and one Gentile. So this is all-inclusive. This is what the Enlightenment is, where no matter what crime you commit, you have protection in the shadows of Freemasonry, because in the daylight, these people are the, you know, the King of Great Britain, the President of the United States, probably. But he might just be I won't even go there. Anyway, this is understanding the difference between genuine Christianity and the influence on whomever embraces Christ and comes into obedience to Christ from the New Testament, from the Scriptures, and what is the underlying cause without which nothing else happens. That's what I'm talking about here. The underlying cause for the Enlightenment is occultism. And until you get that, until you comprehend that, it really is not it's not possible to stress enough the dichotomy, because with Freemasonry, it's always that upper reach, like the crypto Freemason that started the John Birch Society, Robert Welch, the upward reach he always wrote and talked about. And sadly, the John Birch Society is a foil. It's essentially a Freemasonic quasi open, quasi secretive organization. One example is John McManus was a long time Freemason and a long time leader of the John Birch Society. So it's that type of thing. In other words, and right in the middle there, that's where you have fascism. So Freemasonry is fascistic. Philosophically, it is fascistic. Philosophically, it's something that's nastier than what Adolf Hitler did, because Adolf Hitler's flamed out in only 12 years of tyrannical power. The English have been fascist and communist under the rubric, no less, under the rubric of liberal democracy. So when you hear someone toot their horn about liberal democracy, what they're talking about is Lucifer worship as opposed to obedience to Jesus Christ. I thank every one of you for listening to the broadcast today. Write down 608-433-9306 is a brand new phone number. Call between 3 and 4 p.m. every Monday. Glad to have you here for the day.